You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Jericho Parmes, whose book, Lost Wax, a collection of essays, came out last year from University of Georgia Press. Jericho Parmes, the assistant director of the MFA writing program at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and she teaches also at Champlain College. Her essays have appeared in Fourth Genre, The Normal School, Hotel America, The American Literary Review, Brevity, and elsewhere. Her essay collection, Lost Wax, was published in 2016 by the University of Georgia Press. Here's a little information about that book. Jericho Parmes borrows her title, Lost Wax, from a casting method used by sculptors. As such, these 18 essays centered on art and memory offer an investigation into form and content and the language of innocence, experience, and loss. Four sections, each borrowing names from the sculptures of Degas, Bernini, and Rodin, frame a series of meditations that consider the boundaries of the discernible world and the extremes of the body and the self. Here, Parmes draws heavily on memories of a Bronx upbringing in the 1980s and 1990s, explorations in Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and the American West, the struggle to comprehend race, love, family, madness, and nostalgia, and the unending influence of art, poetry, and music. Written largely within the galleries of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she was working at the time, Lost Wax is an inquiry into the ways we curate memory and human experience despite the limits of observation and language. In these essays, Parmes exhibits and examines her greatest obsessions, how to describe the surface of marble or bronze, how to embrace the necessary complexities of identity, stillness, and movement, life and death, how to be young and alive. When I spoke to Jericho Parmes last week, I began by asking her how these essays began for her and how she came to pull them into this collection. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I would say the essay started, you know, somewhat here and there, and it was kind of a piecemeal process. I think I first really began writing the bulk of these essays, or sort of, you know, they kind of started germinating during a few years when I was working in New York at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Art, as you mentioned, sort of runs as a thread through the collection, and I had gotten this job at this museum, and it was exciting, and I thought, of course, I was going to learn everything in the world about art, which was a passion of mine. But what really happened is that my writing really came alive, and I found myself, you know, more and more just sitting in art galleries in front of sculptures and paintings and writing, and the art itself that I was sort of immersed in on a daily basis really became kind of a portal or a vehicle through which I started to get a little bit deeper into, you know, past experiences and memories, and sort of touching on subjects that I knew I wanted to write about, but I think wasn't quite sure how to approach. Right. So art really was a vehicle kind of into my process for writing a lot of the pieces that, you know, ended up being included in the final book. And shortly after, you know, working in the museum, I started an MFA program at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and there started to really kind of understand a little bit more about the essay as a form, and how to engage on, you know, kind of a heightened level in terms of craft and looking at what I was starting to do when I was just kind of writing on my own and really kind of honing those skills. So the book is largely closely what my creative thesis was in graduate school.
Okay.
And then, of course, I took a couple of years to keep revising from there. So it kind of, you know, I always kind of credit, like, the museum, my graduate program, and then, you know, a year or two after when I sort of worked on my own to prepare the essays to send out.
Okay. Now, I was really interested in the fact that you have so many incredibly vibrant and conveyable memories from your childhood. Mm. And I wondered the extent to which those came back to you as you started writing, and maybe as you were writing at the museum, you know, did stuff come back that you had sort of forgotten about, or did you keep journals, or are you just somebody who remembers things really well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I always sort of joke around, you know, with my family, especially, and people close to me, that, you know, I feel like writing is some weird way of exercising memory, you know, like it, and that memory some often kind of feels like a muscle that, you know, as you exercise it, sort of more things come back to you. And I think the process of writing very much keeps memory alive in some ways. And that's something that I try to sort of give attention to when I write.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also say that I think, you know, I think my process tends to be very much open to observation and attention. Again, sort of, you know, writing from looking often at art or from, you know, other images or sort of whatever is around us kind of in the discernible world, and allowing, you know, what we see to lead to description and allowing the art of description to lead to association. And I think sort of just really slowing down that process for me allows me to kind of tap into memory and often really pull out, you know, and cultivate specific images that I remember from the past. And so I really think it's a matter of, again, just sort of allowing yourself to slow down, allowing yourself to pay attention, kind of giving yourself over to that level of attention. And I think when we pay attention, we can actually, it's sometimes amazing what we can remember. You know, I mean, I think, you know, there's also the more kind of practical, like I'll often call up my mom and say, well, you know, can you kind of fact check me here? You know, am I remembering this and that, the other thing, right? So I do kind of use other resources around me as well. My family certainly is very supportive, I think, of the fact that I'm writing and often trying to write about our shared past.
Right.
So I feel grateful for them as a resource. But, yeah, I think a lot of it just comes down to that willingness to slow down and try to pay attention.
Now, you mentioned your family being a part of the memories that you include in the collection. And so even though it's not strictly chronological, the early essays do concern your childhood and your family history. And I was really interested to see the way you braided together childhood memories with the art. It, right away from the first essay, which I think was on Touching Ground. Is that the first essay?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you, in that essay, you look closely at the work of Degas and also the history of wild horses, which he represented horses in his sculpture. But you also use those braiding together with observations about your childhood memories. You grew up with a grandfather who had a ranch and you would go horseback riding. So I just, you know, putting together some of these things, braiding together some of these strands, I'm wondering if that came really naturally once you would get going.
I think it's something that I love about the essay form, is the sort of the ability to bring, you know, other outside information, external information and experiences in. And I think, you know, essays that I really admire tend to kind of both have sort of the panoramic view, but also have that kind of, you know, willingness to look closely. So I think it's something that I try to kind of strive for both, you know, looking at sort of the personal and then also trying to speak to some kind of universal, right, as we often say in, I guess, writing workshops and such. But
universal.
So the personal is the universal, right?
Okay.
So I think, you know, I'll often start with some kind of idea, you know, some kind of experience that I might want to be talking, you know, about or exploring, you know, like my memories of my grandfather, memories of being in that place, you know, the Southwest in Arizona as opposed to the city where I grew up,
right.
Looking at kind of those relationships. And again, also sort of always being open to, you know, the potential for research, the potential for, you know, additional observations that might add various layers to the essay itself. So I think that's where kind of the braiding comes into me. You know, that fall when I started writing that piece, I was reading, there were a lot of stories in the paper about the roundups of wild horses out west. Every once in a while, there seems to be kind of like a resurgence of attention given to that story. So I did happen to be, you know, reading various articles and you know, kind of absorbing as much information as I could about that story, which has always just been of interest to me. And then seeing how I could find, you know, follow the thread of the horse, right, as an image that I was both reading about in the news, that I, you know, knew about this one little corner in the museum that I would go and look at the Degas sculptures in, looking at both the idea of the dancer and the horse, remembering running as a child. You know, so all of those things started to make me think about movement and freedom and the nature of those things. So it's kind of like it's almost like a connect the dots sort of process for me. You know, what I'm thinking about, what I'm reading about, what I'm looking at, and then what I remember. And so I enjoy the process of trying to, as you said, braid all of those kinds of threads together and try to make, make meaning of experience on different levels.
Now, do you ever find the dots not connecting and you sort of have to double back and figure out, like, where did I miss a dot? Or this dot is taking me off course.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah, all the time. I mean, I think it's, you know, a lot of the process is, trial and error a lot of the time. I very rarely will write with any idea of where something's going to end up. So I often find that when I do have a sense of where I'd like it to end up, it generally doesn't get there. It goes somewhere new. So I think it's also just, again, kind of to speak to the potential of the essay as a form, right? Essay, mm-hmm. like to attempt, to try. That's a really freeing process, and I tend to try to allow myself to kind of follow it openly without kind of putting in my own ideas of what anything's going to look like in the end.
So it's
kind of a leap of faith, I guess, each time that somehow I'll find, you know, the balance or the path that each essay needs. But yeah, it absolutely goes wrong most of the time, if not, you know, often.
Well, I didn't mean it goes wrong. It's probably a process.
Right. Yes, exactly.
I'm wondering if you would read from the book just the little section about your New York neighborhood, and then we can talk about it for a minute.
Sure. We lived on the line where the enclave of Riverdale dissolves into the massive borough of the Bronx. Tucked below the Westchester suburbs, the neighborhood is bookended by the Hudson and two-way traffic on Broadway. Orthodox Jewish families stroll the tree-lined streets on Saturdays while the Irish bagpipes sound off a game of hurling at Gaelic Park. On 238th Street, old couples with their Sunday hats and swollen ankles line up outside the diner for the early morning bus to Atlantic City. Slow-moving trains creak along the elevated subway platform, heading one stop north to retire in the train yard near Van Cortlandt Park, which on summer afternoons pulses with salsa or merengue and the sound of backyard barbecue, enough sweetness in the air to make your mouth water for days.
Thank you for reading that. I loved that, and I kept sort of coming back and reading it and trying to figure out exactly what it was about that captured so much. And I think part of it is it's foreign to me. I didn't grow up in a city. But I think the other thing is something that actually was said to me by a faculty member at Vermont College, David Joss, and he said, you know, the scenes of place often will be most resonant if they include the most possible senses. And I was reading this over, and it's like you've got all the senses just right there in that paragraph. You know, you have the smell of backyard barbecue and the, you know, your mouth is watering and the sweetness is the taste. You know, I can feel those swollen ankles, you know, and, you know, everything is a sight and there's the sound of the trains. Anyway, I just thought that was a lovely passage. And I wondered if you're aware of including the senses when you're writing or if that's something that's just sort of happening luckily.
Huh. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it comes sort of back to the art of description, or at least as I understand it, and, you know, always kind of trying to step into a place or a memory or an experience. And I think for me, stepping into it, I think, and trying to re-experience or, you know, a place, et cetera, comes down to the senses. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a great paragraph that you chose, not one that I had originally thought of, but yeah, now I'm thinking, okay, there's sounds and there's smells and all that's in there. And I guess, you know, when I think back to, you know, the neighborhood where I grew up, or when I think back to, you know, the landscape of Colorado where I spend a lot of time, you know, I think, again, kind of allowing yourself to kind of be in that place again, paying attention to how it felt to be there, the things that I remember, you know, observing, the things that stuck with me as images, as smells, as textures even sometimes,
yeah.
Is sort of the only way I can really imagine to convey it, right? And it's particularly if, you know, knowing that this is a very kind of particular place in the Bronx, at Riverdale, as a neighborhood, and that many, many readers wouldn't have the experience of being there, right? So I think the more specific the language and the details can be, you know, the more we may be able to share that experience or convey, you know, I can convey that experience.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And, I think that's a really important point, too, because I think the city is something that can very easily be generalized in those two words. Mm-hmm. And people who aren't familiar will just have this picture of a skyline or of whatever else
right.
they just imagine. And it's a cliche and it's not at all maybe even real. So
sure.
in particular, you know, and I think the same thing can be said for somebody who's trying to write about, you know, a farm, you know, for people that don't ever visit a farm, you
Absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's something I'm pretty, I tend to be aware of that very much so, you know, when it comes to writing about the city, and particularly where I grew up in the Bronx, you know, I mean, even today people hear Bronx and it's like, has all these connotations, right?
Right.
And I think that, you know, that's also important to me to sort of show that place and sort of the complexities and nuances of the city, which is important to me
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah. A lot of the collection goes on and discusses your adult life. I don't want to linger too long on your childhood, although I was really mm-hmm. taken with a lot of those moments. I wanted to talk a little bit about your relationship with your father as told through these stories of how you and he used to, he would play the guitar and you would sing. This was before your parents divorced. I assume that was in the 80s. And then later in another essay, you are actually recording him, you know, talking to you about his memories of his life. And it was important to you as an adult to learn that he remembered those moments with the guitar. And I loved that. I loved how that sort of like crossed through these essays, this thread that was clearly so important to you right away when we first read about it. So anyway, my question actually has to do with how you choose the stories you choose to share, how you decide, like, okay, this is one that I'm going to share. It's very personal maybe, but I'm going to put it out there. And how you maybe choose this one's not so much something I want to share with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think, I think the most of the essays that ended up in this book felt sort of urgent on some level, or that they kind of carried a sense of immediacy in terms of how maybe these essays would come together
mm-hmm.
to, you know, compose a book that would, you know, tell various stories and through those various stories kind of tell a story,
yeah.
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, particularly the essays in the first couple sections of the book that, as you mentioned, do relate more to childhood and place and sort of the origins, you know, like where I come from, who I was surrounded by, family. It was important, I think, for me to, I think on some levels I wanted, you know, to honor, I guess both the sort of, this might sound off, but the pain and the frustration and the challenges.
Yeah, no, that doesn't
but
sound
also
off.
Also kind of, but also sort of the beauty and the creativity and the support that was around me, you know, and so, so there's of course there's an essay that relates to my parents' divorce, which mm-hmm. was very much, you know, has in many ways, you know, been a constant theme for me. How that experience being young and seeing my parents full of idealism and as artists, you know, kind of trying to create this world
mm-hmm.
For our family, and then ultimately that world essentially falling apart in certain ways has been, you know, certainly had effect on me as I've grown up. And that's both kind of laced with, like, horrible memories, and it's also laced
sure.
with like really wonderful kind of magical memories. So I wanted to kind of honor that, you know, that sort of duality, I guess, in my childhood. And, you know, part of that meant, I think, wanting to look close at my specific relationships with my parents.
Yeah.
The Dollhouse essay, I think, looks a little bit more closely at my mother. And then I thought, you know, the experiences with my dad singing, et cetera, was a way that I could kind of honor that relationship as well. And again, when I say honor, I mean both the ways that it's been, you know, fraught and distant and challenging, but also the ways that it's been, you know, hugely meaningful and full of love.
The Dollhouse was a really interesting essay to me because, first of all, it didn't do what I thought it was going to do. It did something completely different. It was so interesting to get to know your child character because your mother took a job building a dollhouse for, I think, a wealthy woman who had bought a kit for this house that was actually inspired by the house in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, the Granville.
Right.
And the whole time I'm reading the essay, I'm thinking about how sad and hard it's going to be for you to let go of this at the end. And in fact, it's not that. It's you're like fascinated by the process of how the house is being built. It's really kind of harder for your mother to let go at the end. And it just said so much about who each of you was, that you as a young child was interested in the artistic process, you know, and where she was at in her life, I think is probably more what the sense of her loss is at the end of that essay, but with her marriage not going well. So I really loved that one. And also just the feat of using It's a Wonderful Life in an essay without having it come off as anything. it was just beautiful. And I think it's hard to use a movie that's that universally known and have it be something fresh and new and interesting. I loved it.
Thanks.
Actually, there's a moment in that essay that I was going to ask you about where you convey your mother's mood in this really wonderful, interesting way. You kind of leave her working on the dollhouse and you say, "Satisfied at least with her smile, I headed off to find my brother. Before I got far, I stopped to listen. The broom swept against the floor, keeping rhythm as my mother, left alone, hummed an incessant song." You know, the push and pull of that sentence, that you're satisfied at least with her smile, tells us she's not a happy person and you're hoping to see happiness there. And then she's humming, but her song is incessant. And, you know, it was just so much more beautiful and evocative than you saying, you know, spelling out what she was feeling. You know, I just loved it. It was a wonderful moment. I'm not asking anything there. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about, so this was something that interested me personally, your essay Mirror, Mirror. You talk about being able to write backwards when you were a little girl. Can you still do that? Can you still write backwards?
I can, yes.
I used to be able to write a mirror image of my signature. Like I would put the pen in my left hand and another pen in my right hand and write my signature and it would go in completely the opposite direction on the left.
Yeah.
And it would be perfect. And I can't do it anymore. I don't know.
It's weird. It's still kind of one of those little quirks that, you know, and I notice it sometimes, you know, if I'm like doodling or just, you know, who knows when my hands just kind of needs to move that often I'll still do it. It's weird.
And you do it with your dominant hand?
I do. Yes, I'm left-handed.
Okay.
And so, I've always done it with my left hand. I can write sort of like legibly with my right hand, but with my left, I can go backwards and forwards.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay. Sorry.
Kind of bizarre.
It's a great. I love that essay too. And another moment. Well, you include little phrases, sort of little. I don't know. Piquant phrases from time to time, and sometimes you write them backwards as well, or you have the typesetting backwards on the page. And then another moment in this essay, you mentioned that you were not, I know from reading these, that you weren't raised with a strong religious influence, and yet you write that you have an obsession with holy books. I thought that was so interesting. Do you know why you have an obsession with holy books?
I don't really. That essay is... I think I remember as I was writing that essay, so much of it became kind of a playful experience, you know, like actually playing with language, seeing how language feels on the page and looks on the page.
Right.
As you mentioned, there's some words where I, you know, kind of meditate on how they appear forwards and backwards or how certain words like mood and doom, right, are sort of the reverse images of each other. And I don't know, and I think the whole, you know, I did include kind of that thread that is that relates to religious upbringing or sort of the lack of that in our family. And at the same time, again, because of the family that I grew up in, I was, you know, auditing Hebrew school with my best friend, and our neighbors were Greek Orthodox, and so I was very, you know, just curious about everything around me and you know, those other sort of traditions and rituals that, you know, people around me who did have, you know, some form of faith or religious practice were engaged in. And I think I saw that as, you know, my only kind of rituals, if you will, as a child were these weird, you know, I write backwards in my journal and I keep lists and I'm kind of, you know, odd that way. But so something about like the ritual of certain religions was really captivating to me.
Yeah.
And still is in a lot of ways. That's interesting you picked up on that.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. You know, it says a lot about the approach that your parents took in raising you and your brother, which, you know, they were sort of bohemian. It sounded like, you know, apart from the fact that there was tension around their marriage and the end of their marriage, they were maybe a little bit, I don't want to use the word loose, but, you know, they were kind of open in raising you to have your own thoughts and your own ideas, and they didn't raise you within a certain religion, and yet here you are very curious as a maybe a teenager or, you know, a middle schooler about religion. I don't know. It's just interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that they did. I think that they took, you know, it was important for them that we just, you know, we had a very diverse world around us, and I think that was important to them, and it's continued to be something that's important to me as an adult. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, later in the collection, you have an essay called Origins, and there's a line that repeats often in that. I think, well, it's split into numbered sections, and in every numbered section, I think somewhere in that section you'll have the sentence begin, "What I want more than anything." And I always love sort of to see refrain in narrative. It feels very poetic. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about including that line and also maybe the poetic value of refrain in your own work.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting you bring up that essay because it sort of circles back to the other question, too, that about the senses. And that essay very much sort of, I think I wrote with, almost as sort of an homage to the senses, right? It's in five sections, and each section sort of relates to a different sense. At least that's sort of that was the hope, right? In the language is sort of trying to kind of capitalize on that sensory experience. So, and I think, you know, the refrain in that essay, the idea of, you know, what I want more than anything, sort of came by accident. I mean, I think I just, that happened to be how I was just entering into each of the sections as I was writing that piece and as I was thinking really about memory and the nature of it and how often I find myself sort of kind of grasping in some way for, you know, images, for snippets for like glimpses, you know, into different experiences from the past. And that just was the language that I kind of attached to that idea, like the sense of wanting, the sense of longing, the sense of sort of grasping for the sensory experiences that I think ultimately make us sort of feel alive in a lot of ways.
Right.
And so that, you know, I started using that language, what I want more than anything, and I think I just, it was sort of a natural return to it a couple of moments in the essay. And then I think once, you know, sometimes you do things and then you're like, oh, this is what I'm doing. And so that's the thing, for lack of a, you know, more
articulate, but that's so,
you know,
great.
Way to put that. And so that was kind of the process. But I think that, you know, again, one of the things I love about the form that of the essay is that it can borrow and can be in conversation with so many other forms. And for me, poetry has been, you know, a huge, huge influence on my work as a writer and just in my reading life. So there's a lot that I admire about poetry and about sort of its uses and when it becomes formal and when it becomes free verse and sort of the spaces in between. that so many, you know, brilliant poets work with.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like the sense that I can maybe like step into a little poet's world for just a minute, even if it's just a line that kind of repeats here and there within an essay.
Yeah, and I think it grounds us too, because when we come to it, we think, oh wait, that was before, and then you might go back and read it again, and then you have sort of a deeper understanding as it gains momentum and takes on, you know, accumulated meaning, I think.
Yeah, and absolutely, I think that's a really important point, the idea of grounding, and I think that sometimes I can get, you know, start to float up in the air a little bit, and I need to kind of ground myself when I'm writing and make sure I'm still, you know, connecting to the page and not going too far into my own head. So sometimes, you know, that repetition can work in that way as well.
I read a quote from you in another interview. I think you were interviewed by a friend who writes for The Rumpus. Mm-hmm. And you said this thing that so resonated for me because I'll tell a tiny story here and then I'll go on to the quote. So when I was working on a novel several years ago, I was having a really hard time containing it. It was just going all over the place. And then I found this musical construct called the Circle of Fifths. I won't go into it. But anyway, it was just this way. I used that toward the work in order to keep myself from going off in all different directions. It contained my work and made me have to really stay within a certain structure. And it worked. Yep. And it really helped me get through that project. So your quote is, tightening the rules and imposing restrictions can free up expression. And I wondered if we can talk about this. A lot of your essays have different forms. I'm not saying that they're repetitive. They're all different and really interesting. But it was clear that in certain essays you had, imposed certain rules for yourself to follow. And I loved the idea that it frees up expression to put restriction on something.
Yeah, that's an idea that I think about a lot. I think that there's so many... And today in particular, and increasingly, there's so many writers who are doing so many interesting things with form. And, essays that I really admire that are, you know, completely, it seemingly kind of giving themselves some kind of structure or some kind of rule or some kind of, pattern within which to write. And sometimes it, you know, and the thing is, sometimes it works really well, and then sometimes it doesn't. Right.
So, right.
But I think when you can find that balance, I mean, there's some really amazing work out there that is playing with structure and form and constraint as well to really, you know, beautiful end, I think.
Yeah.
For me, I've always wanted to see how far I can push certain boundaries of form and structure. I will also say that I think I've been somewhat tentative at times to do that because, again, you know, like anything, we're taking risks and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But in a few essays, you know, I did play around with specific forms. You know, I think there's a list essay where I'm actually numbering the sections.
Right.
Several of the essays deal, you know, use white space as a very deliberate kind of tool. Others have, you know, sections that might start with, there's a piece that works with the laws of motion as section headings. So I think that, you know, when it feels like the form can somehow support or buttress or further the content of an essay, that's when I get really excited. I think the risk we run is that, you know, it seems kind of contrived or unnecessary,
right?
But I think when the form really provides or furthers the content, then that's when it's a good thing.
Yeah, and the other thing is that depending on what form you're choosing, your reader may not even know it's there.
Right.
You know, and you might think it's looking contrived because you've been working on it for the last month or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm trying to think now, which one was this? One of these, the essay, Still Life with Chair. Mm-hmm. Now that essay to me, I mean, it is split into sections, but it didn't seem like it had some sort of very specific form. I'm just going to mention, like, so at the beginning you mention, this is not at all your wording, but you mentioned sitting by a window and feeling restless. And then you move into a story from college. And then you move into a present day trying to recall the story. Then you move into the definition of a chair, because the story from college has to do with a chair. Then you move into the history of a chair, and then you move back to the story, and it goes on, and it goes through lots of different, it touches lots of different places that have to do with chairs or this story. And at first I was feeling like it was a little disjointed, and then you come back at the end to this moment where you're by the window, and I realize, oh my goodness, you know, the restlessness is totally reflected in the structure of this piece, and I really love that. And I went back and read it again, and I just it was a very moving piece. It's a piece that has to do with loss as well as a new love. Anyway, I just wondered if you can talk a little bit about your recollection of writing that piece or maybe editing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because the thread that you mentioned of the kind of present sitting in by the window and the sense of restlessness was a thread that I brought to the essay later on. So initially it was sort of, you know, began really as more of a narrative piece, looking at that specific experience in college with the loss of a friend and then meeting what would become this love for the next several years. And, yeah. You know, that narrative was what it was. It was something I wanted to write about. It felt important. Again, it felt sort of urgent at the time to be exploring that memory and that experience and making sense of it. But at the same time, I think, you know, I think at various points, maybe this is not the best thing to say, but almost when I tend to write just narratively, I think I feel my own mind straying, just kind of almost getting bored.
Interesting.
That's terrible, isn't it?
But no, it's just, no.
So I kind of want to say, okay, well, so here's this narrative and here's what happened. And then, but what, you know, how do I really make more meaning? How do I extract more meaning from this? And that my mind just is always kind of roaming to other ideas that could help me understand, I think, what I'm trying to write. And so, you know, the chair image came from in that the narrative piece, we're looking at a painting during this house party.
Yeah.
And the painting itself depicts a chair. And the more I thought about that as sort of an image that started this whole experience, this evening where we lose Ben and then I meet Joe, the kind of two central figures in the essay, that was the image that sort of set off that evening. And so for me, in the writing of the essay, I thought, well, how can I use this image to further, you know, to further this essay? And
right.
Again, because of just the art history interest, the chair is something that has been depicted, you know, throughout history in paintings and other forms of art. So I really kind of went down a whole, you know, pathway of researching just that and researching sort of the object itself and the object as seen in, you know, depicted in paintings.
And you also found the perfect epigraph to start the essay, which I'm not looking at, so I'm forgetting who said it, but it was like, people don't even see chairs.
Right. It's Theodore Rothke. A funny thing about a chair, you hardly ever think it's there.
Yeah.
The more I was just kind of finding these little facts and these you know, information about chairs, you know, Thoreau, who had three chairs in his house on Walden Pond, and then there's Plato had this whole theory of chairs and these various different kind
right.
of art pieces that have spoken to me over the years. And so I started to think about how, you know, how can we take this quotidian thing, right, that mm-hmm. we interact with every day without, you know, even thinking about it and think about it and apply it to an experience. And, you know, how can, you know, when we apply it to an experience, how can we get, you know, further along in our understanding of that experience.
So
it definitely began, you know, started with the narrative and then the thread of the chairs. And again, as you mentioned, it was kind of all over the place, as you can imagine, and really fragmented, and I was jumping around. And so it did feel like it needed, again, a little bit more grounding of, you know, this is me in the present day thinking about, you know, this experience and trying to make sense of it. And so I decided to actually add that as a you know, you know, a present sort of line.
Yeah.
Say as well.
Yeah, I thought that really brought it together for me anyway. Now, I don't want to move past our specific conversation about the book without mentioning the fact that you have drawings throughout this book and on the cover that are your own drawings that depict your interpretation of pieces of art that are mentioned inside and that actually are structuring the book. You have the book is in four sections. But anyway, can you talk a little bit about the drawings?
Oh, sure. The drawings, it's interesting, they sort of came about a little bit on a little bit of a whim when I was sort of final, you know, doing a final run through and revision of the manuscript. And again, I think it came out of a certain restlessness once again that I was sort of thinking about the overall structure of the book and how to kind of pull all of this together. And I had this idea that, you know, some of the sculptures that, you know, are cited or referenced in several essays might be some kind of organizing principle for the collection. And also speak sort of to the title of the book, Lost Wax, which, you know, comes from a method used by sculptors where a cast is created out of wax and then drained, mm-hmm. Which also speaks to sort of themes of absence and loss, et cetera. So I was kind of thinking about how all of these things might work together to help, you know, guide the book and give it some kind of a structure. And it's, you know, so I was revisiting images that I had of these artworks. I had done a big trip to Rome, actually, to see much of Bernini, you know, a lot of Bernini sculptures and, you know, spend some time with them.
Mm-hmm.
I was going back to the museum to look at these other pieces. And I felt like, because so much of where this work began was from the act of looking, I felt compelled to somehow create a visual component that would go along with just the, you know, the sculpture titles felt like that wasn't quite enough, or that didn't really convey what I was trying to convey. So particularly because, you know, they're obscure sculpture titles. Who really knows the titles of sculptures, right? So,
some people.
So for me, well, yeah, I should.
Other people.
Many really brilliant people know the titles of sculptures. But so it felt, you know, so I just kind of started playing around with thinking about how to, you know, represent those pieces in some way that might add a little bit more or convey a little bit more about the content in those sections. And I've always loved just doing contour drawings, and I used to do them quite a bit when I was in the museum just as a way of sort of remembering what I was looking at. I'm certainly not an artist, and so it's really my one kind of way of capturing sometimes what I'm looking at is through those kind of messy contour drawings.
But I find it hard to believe you're not an artist. They're so engaging and so good, and is it true, like, do you not raise the pen the whole time? You just make one long drawing?
Right, so you have to keep your pen on the page. And I think I like that because it sort of makes you almost, I don't know, it's just, it's the one form of kind of drawing that I've always just kind of let, you know, given myself over to without caring, kind of, okay, well, what's this going to look like?
Yeah.
Or how do I shade this correctly? Or because, again, I don't really have that background of you know, in drawing.
Right. Drafting. You can, at the end, you can go, well, at least I did not raise my pen.
Exactly. And it's sort of, like, it sort of looks like two people.
No, they look great. I mean, I don't know how many you had to do to get these pieces, these
right.
drawings.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I think that speaks to me about the nature of contour drawings is essentially that, you know, you're not given, you know, you might look at that, you know, drawing of Daphne that's on the cover and not necessarily, you know, go directly to that sculpture, or it might not recall, you know, perfectly that image, but I think that it's another form of an impression, you know, and that sort of almost ephemeral kind of nature of the line mm-hmm. that comes out of a contour drawing sort of spoke to me and, again, speaks to, I think, the nature of memory, the nature of, you know, trying to recall or trying to sort of somehow record experience, and that's sometimes going to be messy, and that's sometimes going to look like scribbles, and that's sometimes going to be, you know, something quite removed from the thing itself, but it somehow still exists as a representation.
Okay, that's great. I just have a few more questions for you. First of all, I'm wondering what you might be working on now.
That is a great question. It's funny with, you know, this is a first book, which is exciting. And yet it's meant trying to figure out how to now, you know, just kind of keep a writing practice and re-engage. And I feel like I've been in a bit of sort of just a place where I've needed to kind of recalibrate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I am excited to be working on continuing on, you know, a few threads that I was working with when I pulled together Lost Wax that didn't actually make it into the book. So I'm picking up on a few threads and that relate to the idea of inheritance, the idea of, you know, objects. So I'm working on a series of essays right now that relate to a few kind of odd objects that I've come across that relate to the past or sort of that relate to, you know, questions of inheritance, things that have been left to me, things that
okay.
have been passed down.
Oh, how cool. I bet you could make so much out of that. I mean, you could go looking to see, you know, like what did Dorothy's shoes auction for?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's been fun.
Yeah, that sounds fun. And then I wanted to know what you might have read lately that you would recommend to listeners, either essays or fiction or poetry, whatever.
Yeah, I've actually been reading. I've been on this real kick reading a lot of university presses lately, which I think are doing, I mean, there's so much amazing work coming out of university presses right now, and specifically essays and nonfiction. Right now I've been just completely enthralled with this book by Mary Capello called Life Breaks In. It's a mood almanac.
Ooh.
And well, I just love that title. Life Breaks In, it comes from an Emily Dickinson poem, I'm pretty sure, and then the subtitle, A Mood Almanac, just like, I mean, she's brilliant. And
yeah.
it's all about mood, and it's about the clouds, and it's just, it's a writer's mind kind of working around this idea and this concept, and she's just absolutely engaging.
Oh, that
so
sounds
I certainly
great.
Recommend that. Yeah, and that's from the University of Chicago Press.
Okay, wonderful. Now, your book was published by the University of Georgia Press, and I was wondering how if you could briefly share your story of getting published.
Yeah. So I had always loved the University of Georgia Press, and I credit them as being sort of like they were for a long time kind of a compass for my reading life, and I think particularly the nonfiction that they publish is just so brilliant. I mean, writers like Barbara Hurd and Sarah Gorham's been publishing with them. So
mm-hmm.
They always, you know, were a press that I really admired and looked up to. So when I was ready to send it out, they had recently started this new series called the Crux Series in Literary Nonfiction, edited by John Griswold. And I was excited about that series, and, you know, they had great people on their board, and so I immediately knew that they were, you know, on my list and top of my list. And so, and along with a few other presses that I had always wanted to send to. So when I was ready, I sent to Georgia, and I sent to two presses off the bat, Georgia and then another press, and was just amazed at just they were off the bat, so organized and so responsive. And they got back to me relatively quickly, which was great.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it's a university press, they do a pretty extensive peer review process. So the manuscript goes out to peer readers
mm-hmm.
and then comes back, and then I respond, and then it goes to the board. It's like this amazing process
right.
how they all do it. But what's so rewarding about that is that you're getting feedback along the way from readers, you know, from really wonderful writers that review their manuscripts. And so that was just super, you know, just rewarding and a great process. And then, you know, I think all in all, it took a few months. I think I sent out in May and then had a contract in, let's say, October.
Oh, fantastic.
So, yeah, it was, you know, but it was also the kind of thing where, you know, I was, like, buckled in and ready for the long haul, you know, and I think you need to be, you know, prepared for just sending it and believing in it while it's out there and not going nuts while you're waiting. And
right.
So yeah, but they made the whole process very, very easy, and it was really a pleasure to work with them.
And now you sent it on your own without an agent.
I sent it on my own, yep, without an agent.
And is that standard for university presses, do you know?
I I'm not sure. I think so. I want to say yes, because they tend to have really great guidelines in terms of, you know, writing your letter and, you know, sending the full manuscript as well. You know, so they often like to see the full manuscript that then gets sent out to their peer readers, as opposed to, you know, a proposal or, you know, query letters. So I did a pretty substantial cover letter and sent the full manuscript to them.
Okay. That's really useful to know, because I think people who are writing and maybe haven't been to an MFA program or haven't had a lot of experience trying to get published don't really know how the university presses work. So, and they don't necessarily want you to have an agent before you sign a contract. That's something that you work out with them.
Yeah, so I didn't have an agent even at the time of contract.
Yeah, okay, great. That's interesting. All right, so Jericho, I just want to thank you again. The book is called Lost Wax, Essays by Jericho Parmes, and as we just said, it's published by the University of Georgia Press. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was an interview with Vermont author Jericho Parmes, whose essay collection, Lost Wax, published by University of Georgia Press, came out in 2016. We are streaming at 993wbtv.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Jericho Parmes. This prompt speaks to the process that she sometimes used while writing the essays in Lost Wax. She calls it finding prose or poetry in painting. So look at a painting or a sculpture or an image and free write in list or sentence form everything that you see. Be as specific and detailed as you can. No observation is too acute or obtuse. Think about color, texture, composition, form. Use your senses. Seek words to match the tone, the textures, and the style. Continuing your meditation, allow your thoughts and imagination to roam freely and beyond the canvas. Note any external images or memories that come to mind as you observe the artwork. Seek associations. What are you reminded of? When have you felt this before? What or who, when or where do you find yourself thinking of or grappling with or curious about? So that is Jericho's prompt for you this week, and I'm going to add one more idea to it, which is to try your hand at a contour drawing of the painting or piece that you study in much the same way that Jericho drew some of the works that inspired her while she was writing Lost Wax. Those drawings are included in her collection, and one of them's on the cover. So if you go to the podcast site, I'm going to put the cover up there so that you can see what it looks like. So the exercise would be to draw some representation of the art piece that you're looking at in a single go without ever raising your pen or pencil. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. You can share this show on iTunes, and you can find Write the Book on Twitter and Facebook for updates. You can also find the show on my website, shelaughswithoutus.com. That's just a mnemonic to figure out how to spell my name, which is hard to spell. She Laughs Without Us. The live stream for WBTV is 993wbtv.org, and the show takes place Mondays at 3. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, any book news, you can email me at writethebook@gmail.com. And I do ask that you rate the show in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.